I can't be cut off completely. That's the devil. That's what drives you crazy. Come on, Nat. Join me. One little jigger of dreams, huh? It shrinks my liver, doesn't it, Nat? It pickles my kidneys, yes. But what does it do to my mind? It tosses the sandbags overboard so the balloon can soar. Suddenly, I'm above the ordinary. I'm confident, supremely confident. I'm walking a tightrope over Niagara Falls. I'm one of the great ones. I'm Michelangelo molding the beard of Moses. I'm Van Gogh painting pure sunlight. I'm Horowitz playing the Emperor Concerto. I'm John Barrymore before the movies got him by the throat. I'm Jesse James and his two brothers, all three of them. I'm W. Shakespeare. And out there, it's not Third Avenue any longer. It's the Nile, Nat, the Nile. And down it floats the barge of Cleopatra. Oh, come here. Purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke. Six rings or circles from the drink glasses portrayed the passage of time and the number of drinks she had consumed that afternoon. Soon, there were 12 damp rings visible, double the amount of drinks consumed from before.
That was Rochelle. We are listening to monologues from The Lost Weekend, 1945, for anybody that's just joining us. I don't know why you'd be joining us in part two, but that's what we're doing. Anyone else on this monologue? Because it's worth a whopping 7 points.
Yep, Dylan just loves his drunk monologues.
Also, I didn't misspell theater. I just didn't type the T in there.
Oh, so now you hear me. And that counts as a misspelling, Dylan.
Whatever.
And there actually is another person on that note, and that happens to be theater.
Let's listen to Theater Man doing another drunk monologue.
I can't be cut off completely. That's the devil. That's what drives you crazy. Come on, Nate. Join me. One little jigger of dreams, huh? It shrinks my liver, doesn't it, Nate? It pickles my kidneys, yes. But what does it do to my mind? It tosses the sandbags overboard so the balloon can soar. Suddenly, I'm high above the ordinary. I'm confident, supremely confident. I'm walking a tightrope over Niagara Falls. I'm one of the great ones. I'm Michelangelo molding the beard of Moses. I'm Van Gogh painting pure sunlight. I'm Horowitz playing the Emperor Concerto. I'm John Barrymore before the movies got him by the throat. I'm Jesse James and his two brothers, all three of them. I'm W. Shakespeare. And out there, it's not Third Avenue any longer. It's the Nile, Nate. The Nile. And down it floats the barge of Cleopatra. Come here.
Okay, that was Theater Bound 31.
Ooh.
Anyone else on this monologue?
Let me see.
Seven-point monologue.
The seven-point monologue. 1945, The Lost Weekend. There is one more person.
Who is it?
It is Read to Me.
Okay, let's listen to Read to Me.
I can't be cut off completely. That's the devil. That's what drives you crazy. Come on, Nat, join me. One little jigger of dreams, huh? Okay, it shrinks my liver, doesn't it, Nat? It pickles my kidneys, yes. But what does it do to my mind? It tosses the sandbags over so the balloon can soar. Suddenly, I'm above the ordinary. I'm confident, supremely confident. I'm walking a tightrope over Niagara Falls. I'm one of the great ones. I'm Michelangelo molding the beard of Moses. I'm Van Gogh painting pure sunlight. I'm Horowitz playing the Emperor Concerto. I'm John Barrymore before the movies got him by the throat. I'm Jesse James and his two brothers, all three of them. I'm W. Shakespeare. And out there, it's not Third Avenue any longer. It's the Nile, Nat. The Nile. And down it floats the barge of Cleopatra. Come here. Purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke.
This was an interesting one because all three of them read different to different places in this monologue.
I have you all as different trunks on my notes.
Rochelle read all up past the description of the scene, and then Theaterbound didn't read the purple, the sails, and then Reed read the monologue how it was supposed to be read as far as the length of it. Rochelle, let's talk about Rochelle. I loved your read on it. You sounded so emphatic. Like, you really wanted Nat to believe it, what you were saying, and it was when it sort of tapered off at the end for me a little bit. What did you think?
Yeah, I have that it sobered up at the end.
I hate when women sober up.
I have you down as Rochelle Euler, the bitter drunk. And I loved your voice in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you did sober up towards the end. And I think that might be because of having read more than you should have. So maybe you didn't know where to go with it. I don't know.
Yeah, sorry if that was confusing, Rochelle. Allison, I liked yours. It was a little bit reedy for me, and you didn't really sound drunk. You just kind of sounded like you were reading the words, and it sounded like you were reading. And then you didn't read the Purple of Sails part. So I wasn't sure about this one. What did you think about Allison's?
I have you down as the mellow drunk, because you did sound kind of mellow and a bit reedy. I think I have that you could have sounded a bit more drunk, but I did like the softness of your voice in this.
And then Reed, I really liked yours, Reed. You had like a drunk undertone to yours, but you weren't going overboard with the drunk. And I think it's hard to play drunk. I really liked your read on this one. What did you think?
I have Reed down as the energetic drunk. I thought that his drunken voice and character was really good. The pacing was a little fast at some points, but that worked with it, so that was not a problem for me. And I really just liked this reading a lot.
Well, who was your winner?
My winner was Reed.
My winner was Reed as well, so the Utterly Absurdists get all 7 of those points. And we finally agree on something. I guess we both agreed.
Yeah.
No, this is the first time we've agreed on something tonight, so that's nice.
Hmm.
1946, It's a Wonderful Life, worth 9 points.
Ooh.
Screenwriters Francis Goodrich, Albert Hackett, Frank Capra. Words to cruel Mr. Potter at the loan board in defense of deceased father. I've never seen this movie.
I don't think I have either.
Representing Bedford Falls is Bailey Savings and Loan. George Bailey, played by James Stewart, defended his dead father's name, called a starry-eyed dreamer to the tyrannical, miserly, and cruel Mr. Potter, played by Lionel Barrymore, in an address before the loan board. And who do we have on this one first?
Up first we have Heaven.
Heaven incarnate. Let's listen.
Just a minute. Just a minute. Now hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny ante building and loan, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything about his character, because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me, but he did help a few people get out of your slumps, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Why, here, you're a businessman here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What did you say a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait? Wait for what? Until the children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that... Do you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter. That this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him. But to you, a warped, frustrated old man, the cattle. Well, in my book, He died a much richer man than you'll ever be. I know very well what you're talking about. You're talking about something you can't get your fingers on, and it's galling you. That's what you're talking about, I know. Well, I've said too much. You're the board here. I mean, you do what you want with this thing. There's just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution. If only to have some place where people can come without crawling to Mr. Potter.
That was Heaven Incarnate. Anyone else on this monologue, or does Heaven get all 9 points?
Heaven does not, unless of course he wins it all, because there is one other person coming up, and that is Saigo.
Well, let's listen to Saigo.
Just a minute. Just a minute. Now hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny-ansy building and loan, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character. Because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Why, here, you're all businessmen here. Don't I make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What did you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that... You know how long it takes the working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter. That this rabble you're talking about? They do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be. I know very well what you're talking about. You're talking about something you can't get your fingers on, and it's galling you. That's what you're talking about, I know. Well, I've said too much. You're the board here. You do what you want with this thing. There's just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution, if only to have some place where people can come without crawling to Potter.
What? That was Saigo?
Saigo.
Saigo. We have another person on this monologue, and it's Zigbar.
Ooh.
Let's listen to Zigbar in his sexy accent.
Just a minute. Just a minute. Now hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap, penny-ante building and loan, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character. Because his whole life was... Why in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Why, here, you're all businessmen here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What did you say just a minute ago? That they had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that... You know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter. That this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. And, well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him. But to you, a warped, frustrated old man... They're cattle! Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be. I know very well what you're talking about. You're talking about something you can't get your finger on, and it's galling you. That's what you're talking about. I know. Well, I've said too much. You're the bard here. You do what you want with this thing. There's just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution. If only to have some place where people can come without crawling to Potter.
That was Zigbar.
Zigga zigga Zigbar.
We have... anyone else on this monologue?
We have one other.
Who is it?
It is Genesis.
Okay, we will listen to Genesis now.
Just a minute, just a minute. Now hold on, Mr. Potter, just a minute. Now you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny-ante building and loan, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character, because his whole life was... why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Why, here, you're all businessmen here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... what'd you just say a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home. Wait? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that... you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter. That this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be. Do I know very well what you're talking about? You're talking about something you can't get your fingers on and that's galling you. That's what you're talking about. I know. Well, I've said too much. You're the board here. You do what you want with this thing. There's just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution, if only to have some place where people can come without crawling to Potter.
All right. That is all for the It's a Wonderful Life monologues. This is... last week we had a really close one when we... was it 42nd Street?
Might have been.
And this week, this is the close one because we were really... We really struggled on picking a winner for this one. I don't know who Malt picked. Malt doesn't know who I picked. But we were both really struggling. And it was between all four of you. All four of you had different things to like. So let's talk about Heaven's Reed first. Do you want me to start on it?
I'm trying to remember who started last time. I can't remember. So whoever...
it doesn't matter. I don't care. If you want to start, you can.
Yeah, all right, I'll start. I really loved your accent for this. Like, the accent that you pulled off, like, it was really good. You sounded really angry, which was perfect. I really don't have anything bad to say about any of you.
Malt is totally an accent whore, if you can't tell.
I am an accent whore. Like, it is... okay, Avengers and accents will put you in my good books. As long as you, like, dedicate yourself to
we
it.
We need to have an Avengers monologue off just for you, Malt.
That would be great.
Superhero night.
But yeah, like, I loved the anger, I loved the accent, I just really loved this read.
It was an interesting accent. It kind of sounded like Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors. You were talking so fast at the beginning, plus the accent, it was a little hard for me to understand some of what you were saying. I don't read along with the monologue like Malt does, because I'd rather... do you read along with the monologue?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Not anymore. I used to, but, like I keep it there, so I can glance at it.
Yeah, I've got it in front of me in case I need to check something, but I like to, like, listen. I loved your read on this as well, because it didn't sound like you were reading A, and it never sounds like you're reading, and it had so many great levels. And the end was just, you had the strongest ending of all of them, just the way that you, like, put the button on the monologue. It was really, I really liked what you did with it. Saigo, you've gotten so much stronger as an actor since I first heard you, and this was a really good read as well. I heard you turn on Isn't That Right, Uncle Billy? And When you were saying you knew very well what he was talking about, I really believe that. This is another really strong one. You've really been impressive to me on this show. What did you think about Sega?
I have that, like, once again, really good on the anger. I really liked this read. And, like, I haven't been around to see people really, like, improve so much from, like, where they might have used to be. But for what you did really well with it. The only thing I have to say is that it seemed a little bit rushed. But other than that, I really loved it. And I really don't have anything bad to say.
What did you think of Zigbar?
Zigbar? I don't know what accent you have, but it gave this an entirely different feel for me. And I loved your tone in it. And it was really interesting because you didn't sound very angry. You sounded more sad. And that was like, it was really, really interesting to hear it that way. And I thought it was really cool.
It was interesting. I felt like it was a little meek for what was occurring. Like, I don't know if you had started your speech like that in the scene, like in terms of what was going on in the scene, if anyone would have given you a chance to continue speaking. But I did like the interesting read on it. And then, JC, you had, like, this endearing quality. You had the, like, endearing quality of Jimmy Stewart, and you still spoke with passion. And you had probably the most likable read of this as far as, like, being a likable character. What I love the most about this is how the more you talked, the angrier and more, like, passionate about it you got. So it was like you were, like, convincing yourself even as you were speaking. And I really, really liked that. What did you think of that, Maude?
JC? I have that... Once again, like, the attitude was good, the anger was amazing, and I feel like it was the most believable because you didn't hold back. You let yourself stutter. You let yourself, like, really lose yourself in it, and that was really impressive to me.
Did you pick a winner?
I did.
I did as well. Who'd you pick?
I picked Genesis.
I did as well. So Genesis gets the, is it 9 points?
9 points.
9 points for Team Utterly Absurdist. So they are getting 9 more points.
And I do really want to stress that this was really, really tough.
Yeah, this one was really close, and we had to, like, legit think about it. At least, I know I did, and you said you did
too. I did too. I made Dylan wait for, like, 5 minutes.
It was hard. 1947, The Bishop's Wife, worth 2 points. Screenwriters Robert E. Sherwood, Leonardo Bercovici. A guardian angel's profound yet simple rewritten Christmas sermon delivered by a transformed Episcopalian bishop. This is a long setup.
Yes, it is.
After praying for guidance, Episcopalian Bishop Henry Brougham, David Niven, received divine help in the form of a handsome, suave guardian angel named Dudley, played by Cary Grant. But Dudley was not there to assist with the bishop's building and funding of a new cathedral, but to show Henry what he had been neglecting in life, the poor and needy, the boys' choir, his parishioners, and most noticeably, his lovely wife, Julia, played by Loretta Young, who had the incredible gift, according to Dudley, of making heaven here on earth. Dudley rewrote Henry's Christmas sermon, dictating while the typewriter took down his words. When Henry finally publicly announced the importance of Julia in his life to Dudley, quote, Julia means more to me than my life. I'm not going to lose her, end quote. The angel promptly announced his departure. The angel told Henry that he and everyone else would have no memory of his visit or existence. At St. Timothy's Church, the bishop delivered Dudley's sermon on Christmas Eve at midnight while Julia beamed at him from the pews. From the street outside, under a light falling snow, Dudley listened to the poignant and touching words, satisfied that his work was complete, as he turned and slowly walked away, bringing the film to a heartfelt close. Malt, nobody's on this one, so guess what?
I'm reading it.
Yes! Go!
Tonight I want to tell you the story of an empty stocking. Once upon a midnight clear, there was a child's cry. A blazing star hung over a stable, and wise men came with birthday gifts. We haven't forgotten that night down in the centuries. We celebrate it with stars on Christmas trees and the sound of bells and with gifts, but especially with gifts. You give me a book, I give you a tie. Aunt Martha has always wanted an orange squeezer, and Uncle Henry could do with a new pipe. For we forget nobody, adult or child. All the stockings are filled, all that is except one. We've even forgotten to hang it up. The stocking for the child born in a manger. It's his birthday we're celebrating. Don't let us ever forget that. Let us ask ourselves what he would wish for most. And then let each of us put in his share. Loving kindness, warm hearts, and an outstretched hand of tolerance. All the shining gifts that make peace on earth.
That really touched me.
Oh, thank you.
So nobody did that one. Nobody gets 2 points, so 2 points to me and Malt.
Woo!
We should really, like, keep score for ourselves so we can win.
We should. Just gotta, like, remember.
Yeah. Last. 1948, Treasures of the Sierra Madre. This is the 10-point one.
Yeah.
Who's on this one first? Well, we'll set it up first. 1948, screenwriter's John Huston. Do you want to read the setup?
Where am I? Sure. In a Tampico flophouse before a gold expedition began, grizzled prospector Howard, whilst Walter Huston, delivered a wise description of gold fever, gold's worth, and the seductive devilish lure of gold. He recalled his past gold quests all over the world, ending his tales of experience when he witnessed what gold does to men's souls, by describing how the noble, friendly, and solid intentions of gold seekers always vanished after gold was discovered.
The gold fever speech, I know what gold does to men's souls. And the first person on this monologue is Russell Gold. Ironic?
I think not.
Okay.
Or it could be, really.
All right, let's listen. We'll be back in part 3 with Russ.